From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Why do we value science so much? We certainly love what it's given us, new technologies, new medicines, discoveries about how the world works. But what's behind all this? You might say it's the spirit of free inquiry, the freedom to ask any question under the sun without worrying about anyone's politics or religious beliefs or intellectual bias. So the best idea wins. But is that how science really works? Not according to the maverick British biochemist Rupert Sheldrake, the author of the book Science Set Free. He says modern science is mired in all kinds of dogmas, boundaries you're not supposed to cross, at least if you want to hold on to your job and your reputation. Sheldrake himself has been called a fraud and a heretic. Steve Paulson recently caught up with him.
Why do you think science needs to be set free?
Because I think it's got trapped in a kind of dogmatic belief system. So it's very much built into the practice of science.
So give me a few examples of this. What's part of the scientific creed?
Well, first and foremost, nature is mechanical. The universe is a machine. Animals and plants are machines. The human body is a machine. We're just lumbering robots, to use Richard Dawkins' vivid phrase. That's the first assumption. Second, matter's unconscious. There's no consciousness or awareness in matter anywhere. Atoms, electrons, solar systems, galaxies, it's all unconscious. Then the third dogma or assumption is that the laws of nature are fixed. They were the same at the moment of the Big Bang as they are today, and they'll be the same forever. Nature is purposeless. Evolution has no purpose or direction. Minds are inside brains, confined to the inside of the skull. Those are just some of them.
Well, I want to talk about some of those more specifically, but what strikes me about your very discussion of a scientific creed is how counter I think that runs to what a lot of scientists say. I mean, they say that the practice of doing science is inherently about questioning assumptions and testing new ideas. There's nothing sacred. In fact, they would say that this is what distinguishes science from religion, which refuses to question doctrinal beliefs. You're saying science has its own sacred beliefs?
Oh, very much so. And I think they're actually more pernicious than the dogmas of religion because most scientists don't realize they're there. They think other people have beliefs, but that they know the truth.
But what is it that science cannot explain?
Well, consciousness, for a start. I mean, however much you study nerve impulses and bits of the brain that become active when you look at the color red, for example, you can't explain the experience of redness. The very existence of subjective experience isn't there in physics and chemistry, which is supposed to explain everything about nature.
Okay. One response to this would be to say it's hard to get a handle on that, but it doesn't necessarily suggest that science itself is broken because it can't explain it.
Well, I'm not saying that science is totally broken. What I'm saying is there's certain areas where scientific inquiry is restrained by dogmas and assumptions that really inhibit free inquiry. I mean, consciousness is probably the best known of the problems, but there are other ones where people don't even know there's a problem. For example, the idea the laws of nature are fixed. Nobody was there at the Big Bang to measure. What about the laws of nature? Were they there before the Big Bang? How could they be? If the whole universe evolves, why shouldn't the laws of nature evolve too? So you see, this is a question that's up for grabs. It's something one can discuss and debate, but not if one starts from the assumption the laws of nature are fixed, as if that's a given truth.
Now, you also have some fascinating things to say about the animal world. For instance, homing pigeons, how they find their way. And I guess this goes back to your own childhood, right? I mean, you kind of had a fascination with pigeons.
Yes, I was interested in pigeons. I kept pigeons as a child, and I got very interested, how did they find their way home? Nobody seemed to know. When I was at Cambridge, I was teaching biology at Cambridge, I asked my colleagues, how does it work? And they all said, oh, well, it must be magnetism, or it must be the sun's position. Or they came up with a whole variety of theories. Well, all these theories have now been tested to destruction. It's not just the sun's position, because they can do it on cloudy days and when their time sense is shifted, which they'd need to navigate by the sun. It's not just magnetism, because although pigeons do indeed seem to have a magnetic sense, That can't tell you where you are. It just tells you where north and south are. If you're parachuted into an unknown place and given a compass, you wouldn't be able to find your way home. So there's a huge problem about pigeon homing and bird navigation and migration in general.
You're saying that scientists really still don't have a clue how birds find their way?
Well, they have a clue. The clue is that magnetism plays some role in some species. I myself think that there's a possible explanation. My own hypothesis is that pigeons are linked to their home position by a kind of field. I call it a morphic field, a bit like an invisible elastic band that connects them to their home and, as it were, pulls them homeward. But, you see, you can't study such an unknown thing if you assume it can't exist or doesn't exist. And, again, there's a taboo which inhibits free inquiry here.
Well, you've been talking about your theory of morphic fields or morphic resonance for a number of years now, and most scientists say this is impossible, and there's no proof for it. How do you respond to those criticisms?
Well, saying it's impossible is simply saying the existing dogmas of science are all we need, we know the truth already. What I call the science delusion is the belief that science already knows how reality works in principle, leaving any of the details to be filled in. It's not impossible. I mean, it's perfectly possible.
But is there any
some
proof?
Well, there's quite a lot. Yes, there's quite a lot of evidence that morphic resonance may really happen. For example, in the case of animal behavior, the theory predicts that if you teach rats to learn a new trick in San Francisco, rats all over the world will learn it quicker because the rats have learned it in San Francisco.
Can you explain that?
Quicker.
If rats in San Francisco learn how to do something, why would that catch on with rats elsewhere who had never had any contact with those San Francisco rats?
That's a postulate of the theory of morphic resonance, and maybe I should back up a little and say a little bit more about what the theory says. The theory says that there's similar patterns of activity in self-organizing systems, which include crystals, cells, brains, plants, you know, societies of animals. And what this boils down to is that each species has a kind of collective memory.
It sounds a little like Carl Jung's idea of the collective unconscious.
It is like that. I mean, but Carl Jung was talking about it in relation to humans, and I think that it happens with humans, but all other species too. In fact, I think it's a general principle of nature. So one of the predictions this theory makes is that if rats learn a new trick in one place, they should learn it quicker elsewhere. Is it true? Well, this has been tested, and it turns out that something like this really does happen. I'm not saying the evidence for morphic resonance is overwhelming, but I'm saying that there is quite a lot and that this theory explains a lot of things which regular science doesn't. I'm not saying I'm right, they're wrong. All I'm saying is this is an open question.
Well, what I find so interesting about what you're saying is the fact that you are a scientist yourself. I mean, these are kind of heretical things for a scientist to say. And we should just take a moment to talk about your background. You were educated at Cambridge and Harvard, had a distinguished career in biochemistry, became a research fellow at the Royal Society and a professor at Cambridge University. When did you start to question the materialist assumptions of science?
I think when I was at Harvard, I read Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and that made it clear to me that science at any given time is not the truth. It's a consensus reality. Kuhn showed that scientists are social beings like everyone else, and that normal science happens within that framework. To challenge its assumptions is heretical, but scientific revolutions occur when a new framework of thinking is established, and then normal science takes place again within that framework. But it was really my work in developmental biology at Cambridge that made me realize that no one knew how morphogenetic fields could be inherited. And it was really the thinking about that, the inheritance and evolution of these fields, that led me to think of the idea of morphic resonance, a kind of memory in nature over and above genetic inheritance. I then put forward the theory. I put it forward in my first book, A New Science of Life, recently reissued in a new edition as Morphic Resonance.
And we should mention that it generated quite a response. John Maddox, the editor of the journal Nature, famously said that your book should be burned.
Yes, well, you see, that's what made me realize that science is not a level playing field where different ideas can be freely discussed in a rational spirit. He branded my work heresy, and, as it were, Maddox tried to excommunicate me from the scientific community. One of the reasons that I wrote this book, Science Set Free, is because I think this same stigma against heresy applies in many areas of science. It terrifies most scientists. Most scientists are not prepared to come out and talk about their doubts or unconventional theories unless they're in a very, very powerful position, like a Nobel Prize, then they can become more unconventional. But it's career suicide to question the dogmas. You won't get your grants renewed. You won't get your papers in high citation peer review index journals. You won't get promotions or tenure or whatever. There's a reign of fear in science which is completely at odds with the ideal of free inquiry.
You're really asking scientists to come out of the closet, the explicit analogy here to the gay rights movement.
Well, exactly that, yes. I think science is full of closet holists or people who have religious beliefs or spiritual practices or psychic experiences or who go to alternative therapists and so on, but who don't dare tell their colleagues. I know this is the case because what gave me this idea actually is that I was once asked to give a seminar on some work I did on dogs that know when their owners are coming home. It appears to be a telepathic effect. Many dogs seem to know when their owners are coming home in a way that can't be explained by routine or familiar car sounds or people at home knowing. Anyway, I did lots of experiments on this and published them in peer-reviewed journals. I gave a seminar on this at a leading British university in the veterinary school. There were 6 members of staff and some students. It was a small group. After the seminar, over tea, one after another of the members of staff came up to me and said, "I know this is true because my dog knows when I'm coming home from the lab. My wife always knows when I'm coming." Another one said, "We had a dog that did that when I was a child, and it's one of the reasons I went into this whole field of study." All of them came up and said they were interested, they thought I was right, but they all said, "I can't discuss this with my colleagues because they're all so straight." I said to them, "You know, why didn't you guys come out? Because you'd have so much more fun."
And I should mention that your ideas about telepathy have, not surprisingly, generated a lot of criticism. And one of your sparring partners, the well-known British biologist Lewis Wolpert, has described telepathy as pathological science. Peter Atkins, a famous chemist at Oxford University, has said work in this field is a complete waste of time. It's a fairly standard response from scientists, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And you see, this is one of my points about scientific taboos, why it's an illusion to think scientists are free, open-thinking people who just look at the evidence rationally. I challenged to both those gentlemen, Lewis Wolpert and Professor Atkins, two public debates. I had one with Professor Wolpert at the Royal Society of Arts in London. It was reported in Nature, the scientific journal. I presented half an hour's evidence for telepathy from hundreds of published papers. I showed some videos of experiments and so on. He stood up in complete ignorance of all this evidence and simply said over and over again, "It's pathological science, it's rubbish, it doesn't happen," with no evidence whatsoever. When I was showing the evidence, he was sitting on the stage. He was staring into the audience, tapping a pencil on the table, sighing as if bored, and not even turning around to look at the evidence that was on the screen behind him. And when I debated with Professor Peter Atkins, who denounced this as rubbish, I said, "Have you actually looked at the evidence?" And he said, "Certainly not." And I said, "Well, why not?" And he said, "Because I know it's not going to be reliable." And I said, "Well, have you actually read my papers on the subject?" He said, "No, but if I did, I'd be very suspicious of them." So I said to him, "Well, you know, there's a word for that. It's prejudice."
Biologist Rupert Sheldrake talking with Steve Paulson about his book Science Set Free. You can find the complete unedited version of this conversation on our website at ttbook.org. So what do you think of Sheldrake's critique of modern science? You can let us know on our Facebook page. 50 years ago, the physicist Thomas Kuhn wrote a scholarly book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. First, it was hardly noticed, but over the years, it turned into one of those rare books that actually changed the way we think. Thanks to Kuhn, the words paradigm shift have entered our common lexicon. But what did Kuhn actually say? Here are a few excerpts from his landmark book on its 50th anniversary.
Normal science, the activity in which most scientists inevitably spend almost all their time, is predicated on the assumption that the scientific community knows what the world is like. Much of the success of the enterprise derives from the community's willingness to defend that assumption, if necessary, at a considerable cost.
I am Tom Broman, a professor of history of science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. For our discipline, Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions remains the most well-known book in the history of science. Kuhn gave us a method for understanding how scientific knowledge changes in a way other than the straight accumulation of factual knowledge. What Kuhn posited instead is that science has undergone a succession of major conceptual revolutions in which entire worldviews change, so that the worldview of the ancient world, views held by Ptolemy and Aristotle, were replaced by Isaac Newton and René Descartes, and those in turn were replaced by Max Planck and Albert Einstein.
Some revolutions are large, like those associated with the names of Copernicus, Newton, or Darwin, but most are much smaller, like the discovery of oxygen or the planet Uranus. The usual prelude to changes of this sort is, I believe, the awareness of anomaly, of an occurrence that does not fit existing ways of ordering phenomena. The changes that result, therefore, require putting on a different kind of thinking cap.
It's very important to understand that Kuhn believed, both as a PhD physicist but also as a historian, that we always approach the world with a set of sort of conceptual frameworks. We do our science through these frameworks. These are really what the paradigms are that he talks about. And because we work through the paradigm, we can't see the world beyond it.
The historian of science may be tempted to claim that when paradigms change, the world itself changes with them. Led by a new paradigm, scientists adopt new instruments and look in new places. It is rather as if the professional community had been suddenly transported to another planet.
Kuhn's idea of normal science and revolutionary science is really the meat and potatoes of his argument, because in normal science, we are working through the sort of details of the paradigm. And Kuhn thinks that what scientists do over great majority of their work is to work in the paradigms of normal science. And in fact, a lot of what he describes as normal science could be compared to puzzle solving, where you're trying to fit the pieces into a framework. And what happens in the course of doing normal science is that scientists encounter puzzles which don't fit the pattern. But eventually, Kuhn believes, enough such pieces accumulate where scientists' beliefs and assumptions are thrown into doubt, and that's what leads to scientific revolution. Tom Kuhn was born in 1922, and he attended Harvard University in the 1940s, first as an undergraduate and then as a graduate student in physics. He graduated with a PhD in physics in 1949, and at that point, he tells us in the second edition to Structures of Scientific Revolutions that he entered the Harvard Society of Fellows, and that gave him 3 years of pure reading and study, which allowed Kuhn to deepen his knowledge of the history of science. And it's there, he says, that he really began thinking through the nature of scientific change as a historical process.
Almost always, the men who achieve these fundamental inventions of a new paradigm have been either very young or very new to the field whose paradigm they change.
Thomas Kuhn's biggest intellectual adversary when the Structure of Scientific Revolutions came out was the prominent philosopher of science, Karl Popper. And it was Popper who popularized the idea that the method of science is to proceed by falsification, creating hypotheses about nature, which could be falsified. Kuhn, who had been trained as a scientist, implicitly was claiming that philosophers such as Karl Popper did not really understand how science works.
Only when they must choose between competing theories do scientists behave like philosophers. Though the world does not change with a change of paradigm, the scientist, afterward, works in a different world.
Excerpts from The Structure of Scientific Revolutions and other essays by Thomas Kuhn. We also heard from University of Wisconsin historian of science Tom Broman. Coming up,
the stories behind two remarkable scientific discoveries. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Sometimes it takes an obsessive, single-minded personality to make a great scientific discovery. It was certainly the case for two people who devoted their lives to cracking the code of a mysterious language from ancient Greece. Journalist Marguerite Fox chronicles this remarkable story in her book, The Riddle of the Labyrinth. She tells Anne Strainchamps how this language was discovered.
Picture yourself on a beautiful spring day. The year is 1900. You're in the wilds of northern Crete near Heraklion. The great English archaeologist Sir Arthur Evans has just unearthed the ruins of a sprawling, magnificent Bronze Age palace at Knossos, which he immediately dubs the Palace of Minos after the legendary ruler who built the labyrinth with the terrible Minotaur inside. In some of the rooms of this 3,000-year-old palace, Sir Arthur uncovers caches and caches of clay tablets with the strangest writing ever seen. Weird little pictograms of horses' heads, chariots, swords, squiggles, circles. It looks like no writing system known to man. And this writing, which he dubbed Linear B, became one of the great mysteries of the 20th century because no one even knew what language they were written in. So it was the ultimate problem in code breaking. And not surprisingly, it took more than 50 years for the riddle of Linear B to be solved.
To put this in context, you point out what a remarkable thing a written language is. You called it a map.
We tend to take writing for granted. But in fact, writing systems are very rare and precious commodities, and in some estimates, only about 15% or so of the 6,000 languages spoken around the world today even have written forms at all.
Wait. And that's astonishing. Only 15% have written forms?
Right. It's entirely possible to have a language without a writing system, but not so the other way around.
So with Linear B, people were just completely in the dark. Could they even tell if there were sentences or words?
This was exactly the problem. The one thing they were able to determine was that each of these weird little characters of Linear B very likely stood for one syllable. In that respect, it functioned much as the Japanese writing system does today. And there is a trick. You count the number of different characters in the system. If it's an immense number, you have a system like Chinese where every character stands for a different word. A smaller number means you have a syllabic system. A still smaller number, like our 26 letters, means you have an alphabet.
Well, the heroes of your story are the two code breakers who worked on Linear B. One of them is a woman who nearly vanished from history herself, and you've kind of rescued her, Alice Kober. Can you tell us about her?
With pleasure. One of the great surprises, and as it turned out, privileges of doing this book, was getting to write this unsung piece of women's history, like so much of women's history, still by definition unsung. Alice Kober was an overworked, underpaid professor of classics right here at Brooklyn College in New York City, who in the 1940s, working on her own at her dining table in Flatbush, Brooklyn, made herself, because she was brilliant, determined, obsessed, and had a ferocious intellect, made herself into the world's leading expert on Linear B.
And the remarkable thing about this is it's not as though there were guidebooks to tell you how to decipher an ancient language. She had to figure out how to do this, and she deliberately set out to prepare herself. She taught herself, gosh, I think 7 different ancient languages.
That's right. Chinese, ancient Egyptian, all sorts of ancient languages of Asia Minor.
And even more remarkable, this was all before computers. So you paint this picture of her sitting at home at her dining room table night after night, year after year, with thousands of index cards, which she made herself by hand.
Because Alice was working during World War II and afterwards, many commodities that we take for granted were very, very scarce in America. One of them was paper. And so she, by hand, cut nearly 200,000 3x5 cards from the backs of church circulars, old greeting cards, and she kept them. It's kind of tragic because this is almost certainly what killed her. She kept them in these homemade file boxes that were empty cigarette cartons that were just the right size for these slips she made, and on each slip she would write data about all of the patterns for every word and every character in Linear B, 200,000 times over.
That's a lot of cigarettes.
Yeah, that's a lot of cigarettes. And she died very young. She died at the age of 43, 2 years before the code was cracked, almost certainly of some terrible kind of cancer.
It's just tragic that she didn't live long enough to finish her work. Who did?
Her work was finished by an equally obsessed and equally brilliant young Englishman named Michael Ventris, who solved the riddle of Linear B in 1952 when he was barely 30 years old. Mm-hmm. And the fascinating thing about Ventris, besides how young he was and how obsessed he was that after having seen the Linear B tablets in a museum on a school trip when he was about 14, he was obsessed with them ever since. And he, too, tragically died very, very young.
So when Michael Ventris finally deciphered Linear B, how dramatic an event was it?
It was big, big news. It was on the front page of the Times of London. He deciphered the script in 1952. The big public announcement came the next year in 1953, and by coincidence, Edmund Hillary had reached the summit of Mount Everest, and I believe that the account of Hillary and the account of Ventris's discovery were in the paper the same day, and as a result, Ventris's decipherment of Linear B was often called the Everest of Greek archaeology. That's how big it was.
Wow. You said he died just shortly after that, and somewhat mysteriously. What happened?
That's right. The curse of Linear B, scholars call it. It seems people who work the most passionately and the most brilliantly on this script seemed consigned to die young, alas. But Ventris solved the riddle in 52, a month shy of his 30th birthday, and overnight, because it was world news, his life changed. Here, this very brilliant but in some ways very insecure young man who had never been to college was suddenly asked to speak before learned bodies at Oxford and Cambridge, and as academics will, there was a lot of jealousy, there was a lot of sniping. What he determined was that Linear B wrote a very early Greek dialect 500 years before Homer's time and a full 1,000 years before the Greek classical age. And in 1956, 4 years after Ventris cracked the code, he died in a violent late-night car crash that may well have been suicide. But what we do know from his correspondence is he had become deeply depressed by that time. And as he writes in one painful letter, "I've begun to doubt the value of both my vaunted intelligence and indeed of life itself." And so one night, very late at night, he's driving alone and he pulls off the highway at very high speed, collides with a parked truck, and that's the end of his life. So Linear B has this obsessive component and also a tragic component.
Marguerite Fox is a senior writer for The New York Times. She talked with Anne Strainchamps about her book, The Riddle of the Labyrinth. Stephen Greenblatt is a renowned Shakespearean scholar with a gift for writing popular books about arcane subjects, like his recent book about a poem by the Roman philosopher Lucretius and how its rediscovery in a medieval monastery helped launch the scientific revolution. Greenblatt's book, The Swerve, won both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. But as he tells Steve Paulson, Greenblatt first came across this book by Lucretius entirely by accident.
Many, many years ago, when I was a student, I used to rummage around in the bins of used books at the end of the year at Yale. I one day turned up a book paperback for 10 cents called On the Nature of Things by Lucretius, and I was attracted to it because it had a weird, slightly off-color image on the cover of two pairs of legs up in the sky. You couldn't see the torsos doing something. I thought, oh, that's odd. But I saw, of course, that it was an ancient work of physics, and I thought that was way out of my range, but I bought it anyway. And I'm glad I did, because when at some point over the summer I started to read it, I was amazed by it.
Hmm. So what was so amazing about this book?
Well, for one thing, it's extraordinarily beautiful. It's got absolutely remarkable, passionate visions of Venus and Mars, of dreams of pleasure, of chilling descriptions of plague and so forth and so on. It's just a terrific read. But more importantly than that, I had that experience of discovering the doctrine that said not just that the world doesn't have a providential creator, but that the soul is made up out of the same atoms that the body is made up out of, and that when the body dies, the soul will die as well. That people who couldn't possibly have known this actually did know it about life, about the universe. That thrill of discovering a kindred spirit who lived, in this case, thousands of years ago.
And even about physics. I mean, that's kind of a remarkable thing. I mean, yeah. He has kind of a view of the world as made up of atoms. He wrote this 2,000 years ago.
We don't want to exaggerate. He got a million things wrong by our standards of what's right and wrong. But he came up with an astonishing number of notions that turn out now to be pretty close to what we think is the case, starting, as you say, with the idea that everything that exists is made up out of tiny, invisible particles that are constantly moving, that everything comes into being because it's banging up against each other in experimental ways and coming apart again because it's mutating and adapting.
Now, there are really two stories here. One is the story of Lucretius, this poet-philosopher who lived in ancient Rome and wrote On the Nature of Things, and then there's the rediscovery of the book 1,500 years later. But let's talk first about Lucretius. So he was a follower of Epicurus, the great Greek philosopher who's best known for celebrating pleasure as the ultimate goal of life.
Lucretius is not just a follower but a disciple. He believed that anything that you would create that was decent in life, that was worth pursuing for yourself and for others, depended on maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain for yourself and others.
So Lucretius was widely known back in his day. I mean, many other writers referred to this book, and then it disappeared. What happened?
Well, partly it went under in the general disappearance. There was a huge, massive vanishing of the traces of classical culture. Once the ramparts of the Roman Empire at that point began to crumble, and the Visigoths, the Goths, and so forth began to make their incursions into Rome, people had other things to worry about than public libraries or private libraries, than the copying of books. And of course, the only way this is in a preprint world, the only way things survive is to be copied over and over again. So huge amounts went under. It actually is astonishing that in the early 15th century, the major work articulating this entire vision of the world suddenly turned up. Really, it was as strange as if a flying saucer had come down and landed on Earth and people got out speaking your language and spoke a message for you, but that you could barely understand.
So this takes us to the second part of your story, the rediscovery of this remarkable book by Lucretius. Tell me about the man who found it.
The man who found it was a lifelong papal bureaucrat. He was a poor boy. Poggio Bracciolini, his name was. He was born in 1380. Poggio, as a teenager, came alone to Florence with five pennies in his pocket, as he says, and he made his way because he had fantastically beautiful handwriting in a time in which beautiful handwriting was prized. And eventually, he took off and started to look for books. I think it was because he saw that at this moment he could fulfill this lifelong dream of finding the traces of the ancient past. And he starts going to monasteries that haven't been explored yet.
And monasteries were really the repositories of these ancient texts. If anyone was going to save them, it was going to be a monastery.
Absolutely. It's the only game for literacy in town, basically, for centuries. Everything else has collapsed. The schools have all closed. Only the monasteries decided that they would prize books and that they would keep books and that books would be part of the discipline. Reading books and copying books would be part of the discipline of being a monk. In any case, he showed up at a monastery and he was extremely alert to what they might have. And he found a poem that was fantastically beautiful. So the ideas in that poem were regarded as either incomprehensible or wicked or both. But the poetry was beautiful.
Incomprehensible, I suppose, because of the dismissal of the divine. I mean, Lucretius was saying, we don't need the gods. 15th century, we're talking about a world that was entirely dominated by Christian thinking. You almost couldn't think outside that framework.
Absolutely. It was the daily bread of everyone. And what could it mean even for ourselves? It's extremely difficult for ourselves to imagine how it's possible for there to be a universe of such richness and complexity and beauty without someone who's made it as an architect.
And then add to that the fact that Lucretius was an Epicurean, I mean, someone who believed in pleasure above all. And, I mean, this cuts so deeply against the grain of Christian culture at that time. I mean, this was the era when the devout would flog themselves to show their purity.
Absolutely. And the dominant belief was it was suffering that created depth and piety. The pursuit of pleasure was something for a pig, not for a human.
So what happened then once Poggio made this book available? I mean, he circulated it. What kind of reception did the book get?
Eventually, people begin slowly, quietly to talk about it, but carefully. Because when you do take it in, if you have a taste for living, you don't embrace these ideas as your own. The greatest philosopher of the 15th century was a Florentine named Marsilio Ficino, who was fascinated by Lucretius and began as a very young man to write a commentary on it. And then at a certain point, he burned that commentary and renounced it because he saw where it was leading. And so it took a very long time, but it's extremely difficult to stamp dangerous ideas out. And it became almost impossible after Gutenberg's invention of the printing press.
What you're really describing is the making of the Renaissance, which to some degree was a reaction against the dominant Christian culture of the time. I guess the question is what role this book by Lucretius played in this new way of thinking.
There are currents from this book that pass like electric currents through some of the figures that are most important to us in the Renaissance. There are currents that pass through Machiavelli. There are currents that pass through the work of the great essayist Montaigne in France. There are odd traces of it in Shakespeare. It is circulating in a kind of careful, canny, disturbing way, and there are very strange, powerful visions of it in places we would not expect to find them, such as Botticelli's great painting of the Primavera, which is very closely based on lines taken from Lucretius. So there are signs of reception. But you had to be careful. The people who weren't careful, and the most spectacular instance is the philosopher Giordano Bruno. Bruno was taken out and burned at the stake. So the question, Steve, is how come these ideas survive given the fact that they are poison to the people at the time? And the answer, at least in part, has to do with that strange thing that we mentioned before, which is that this is a poem. It's a beautiful poem. It's this weird moment at which perfectly splendid poetry and science are hand in hand, as they really won't be again, maybe ever, and are working it toward the same end.
Stephen Greenblatt's book is called The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. He talked with Steve Paulson. And that poem by Lucretius? We thought you'd enjoy this excerpt. Substance is eternal. This terror, then, this darkness of the mind, not sunrise, with its flaring spokes of light, nor glittering arrows of morning can disperse, but only nature's aspect under law, which, teaching us, hath this exordium. Nothing from nothing ever yet was born. Fear holds dominion over mortality only because, seeing in land and sky so much the cause whereof no wise they know, men think divinities are working there. Meantime, when once we know from nothing, still nothing can be create, we shall divine more clearly what we seek. those elements from which alone all things created are, and how accomplished by no tools of gods. Suppose all sprang from all things. Any kind might take its origin from anything. No fixed seed required. Men from the sea might rise, and from the land the scaly breed. And fowl full-fledged come bursting from the sky. The horned cattle, the herds, and all the wild would haunt with varying offspring, tilth and waste. Nor would the same fruits keep their olden trees, but each might grow from any stock or limb, by chance and change. Indeed, and were there not for each its procreant atoms, could things have each its unalterable mother old? But since produced from fixed seeds are all, each birth goes forth upon the shores of light, from its own stuff, from its own primal bodies. And all from all cannot become, because in each resides a secret power, its own.
An excerpt from On the Nature of Things, a poem by Lucretius. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Here's a story about a remarkable Kenyan woman. Daphne Sheldrick grew up on an African farm, where she turned her passion for wildlife into a career. For more than two decades, she was co-warden of Kenya's Tsavo National Park. She campaigned against elephant poachers and threw herself into raising orphaned animals. Now, Dame Daphne Sheldrick, she's written a memoir called Love, Life, and Elephants. Her story begins with a hair-raising encounter.
You know, we were looking for this elephant called Eleanor, who used to be an orphan. I've known her since she was two, and I had a friend with me who was very anxious to meet her. So we drove around the national park in Tsavo National Park, which is a very big place. It's 8,000 square miles, the size of Michigan State. I'd seen her the day before amongst a wild herd, and I just stopped the car and called her, and she'd come out of the herd, and she'd put up her big foot, and you put your arms around it, and we have a little chat, and then she goes back into the wild herd. So we were looking for her, and we came to this waterhole, and this cow approached, and it actually didn't look anything like her, but I was so convinced that no wild elephant in Tsavo National Park, where they've been poached very badly by people for ivory, would actually approach a strange human being. They have no reason to have any fondness for human beings there. But that's where I was wrong, and this is a lesson that I could never have learnt any other way, that elephants are intelligent and sophisticated enough to actually pass a message to another one. This turned out to be Eleanor's best friend, a cow that we later gave a name to, Catherine. But at that point in time, I said to the friend who was with me, I don't think it's Eleanor. It doesn't look anything like her. So I said, well, we'll soon find out. I'll call her, and if it's her, she'll come to me, and if it's not, she obviously won't. Well, this cow walked straight up to us, and we were able to actually touch her trunk and cheeks, and the eyes were very mellow, and my first words were, Eleanor, you've put on weight. She looked different. But I thought, well, that has to be her. And he said, can you go and stand next to her, and I'll take a picture. So I planted myself next to her great big front leg and put my arm up to touch behind the ears, which is something I always did with Eleanor. And the cow flinched, and she just flicked me, got me with the, not the sharp end of the tusk, but the middle of the tusk, and used the trunk as well, and threw me using the force she would on another elephant. Well, I'm not a lightweight, but
But you're not another
elephant. I fell against this jagged sort of boulders, smashed the leg, and I couldn't get up. It was an open wound. There was blood and bone everywhere. And then this cow came to me, and I thought, my God, now she's going to kill me. I thought it was my last moment. And I turned onto my stomach because for some reason, I just didn't want to be skewered from the front. And I could feel her putting her tusks underneath my body and trying to lift me. So I knew she wasn't going to kill me, because that's not how they kill people. They usually kneel down and use the top of their head. And then she sort of stood up over me and put up this great big foot and felt the wound very slowly, moved it all over my body using the trunk as well. And then she tried to lift me again, and again I shouted, no, no, no. And She looked at me for a little while and then wandered off.
This would have been for anyone else an absolutely terrifying moment, but you relate it quite calmly, as though it's just part of the years you've spent with a civilization of elephants.
Well, I knew that this cow was actually trying to help me, because if she'd wanted to kill me, she could have done it very easily. Mm. But that incident left me with a broken leg that took 15 months to heal.
But did nothing to break your attachment to elephants?
Oh, no. You know, I understood now that elephants can communicate a very sophisticated message to one another, and that Eleanor had obviously informed this cow that I was a friend.
Which was why she allowed you to come so close, and why she came when you called.
Exactly. Well, she thought, well, I'm not Eleanor, but this is Eleanor's friend. I better go and sort of be polite.
You had by then spent a lot of time with elephants. In fact, you grew up on a farm in Kenya. Were there always animals in the wild in your life?
Yes. When I grew up on this farm in the highlands, wild animals were very prolific everywhere. And I had my first orphaned little bushbuck when I was about 3 or 4 years old. Holidays were spent under canvas in wild places, and I married into the wildlife service and lived in Tsavo National Park for many years, which holds the largest population of wild elephants in Kenya, yeah. And was able to observe, elephant behavior. And, of course, my husband was an encyclopedia about all this.
You married David Sheldrick and lived with him. He was the warden of Tsavo?
Yes, he was.
It wasn't just elephants that the two of you were interested in. You had a variety of orphaned animals you took care of, didn't you?
Yes. We would take in any animal that we felt we could return to the wild when it was grown, rehabilitate. We never believed in keeping them captive. I've raised most of the indigenous antelopes, from Dick Dicks to elands, and about 23 Cape buffalo, about 15 black rhinos, all sorts of little smaller things like mongooses and genet cats and all that type of stuff.
I think the casual observer looking at this can understand your attraction to elephants. A rhino, on the other hand, seems a little daunting.
Rhinos, they're very ancient animals. Rhinos have actually been unchanged for something like 60 million years. But they're complicated because they work through chemistry and scent, and fiercely territorial. So although they're quite easy to hand-rear on artificial milk compared to an elephant, they're very, very complicated to actually re-establish back into a resident wild community. And that involves, first of all, replacing the mother figure, not just with one person, but with several people. You mustn't get the rhino too attached to one person, otherwise it simply won't follow another. And walking around the dung piles and urinals of the wild ones, because everything works through chemistry and scent, and they all contribute to communal dung piles. And so the resident rhino will come to the dung pile, find the scent of a newcomer, think, oh, this one doesn't belong here, follow the scent trail, because they kick their dung, put their scent on their feet, and through a special gland in the roof of the mouth, take some of the urine into the mouth and breathe in. And through that, they'll be able to determine through the hormone levels, male, female, rank, everything they need to know about the others, they know from the communal dung piles and urinals.
How absolutely extraordinary that is.
And if they know one another, they can be very social. They'll meet up at dusting places. But if they don't know someone, everyone will be trailing the scent of that newcomer, and he'll be killed straight away. So it actually takes 3 years to integrate an orphaned rhino into a resident community. And it's complicated because all the wild rhinos will be bent on killing that newcomer to begin with, but they'll be scared of the humans. So the humans are the protection.
One of the things that interests me is your statement that you had to have several different humans become involved with each of the rhinos. And I gather from the book that it is not just rhinos you found that true of, that it was a good idea for several to be involved in the raising of all of the orphans so that they don't become too attached. Is that right?
Well, certainly elephants, they need a family. So this is a mistake I made with the first one I hand-reared, Aisha. You know, there was just me, and then when I had to leave her because my daughter was getting married, I had somebody else to look after her, but it wasn't me. and she died of a broken heart. So I then knew that I'd made a serious mistake. There should have been many people, and in the nursery now where we raise the elephants, we've got 20 in there at the moment. A different keeper will be sleeping with every elephant in a stable or stockade every single night, and they rotate so that all the elephants know all the people and all the people know all the elephants, all the keepers, and they keep in touch.
This seems like nothing so much to me as similar to sending your child off to college or to be married. It's hard to break up the family, but everybody kind of understands.
Well, it's, you know, elephants are very emotionally identical to us humans. You know, they've got many attributes that we don't have. They can communicate with infrasound, which carries a long distance, low frequency sound. They can hear seismic sound through their feet. I'm convinced that they can communicate with telepathy as well. And they have a memory that far exceeds that of ours. So in many respects, they're much more sophisticated than us. And they're actually much nicer. They're very gentle. Although they're very big and strong, with elephants you reap what you sow. And if you've only treated them with tender, loving care and kindness, they will do the same to you.
That's Dame Daphne Sheldrick. Her memoir is called Love, Life and Elephants. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Do you have any thoughts about what you've heard today? We'd love to hear from you. You can go to our website at ttbook.org or to our Facebook page. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the show Scientific Revolutions. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Joe Hartke. Our TT Book theme remix was created by Chris Bocast. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You'll find more than 10 years of archived interviews and old shows on our website at ttbook.org, which you can stream, download, and share with friends.
PRI, Public Radio International.